Hey, buttheads. Welcome back to Bob Zemeckis It's Not a Butthead. I'm Richard. Hey, Kyle.
Hey, Richard. This is Kyle Bogart here.
It's us again on another podcast. Kyle, I'm stoked to talk about this today with you. Tales from the Crypt.
It's Witches Month here on the podcast. Witches Month.
Yeah, that's right. Witches Month. I'm actually reading that book right now.
Oh, really? You're going hard, Richard. How many novels will you have read to get through this podcast?
You know, more than I anticipated.
Yeah, I think I count three so far.
It's Roger Rabbit, Witches, mm-hmm. Contact, Forrest Gump, probably Beowulf, Christmas Carol, I'm going to have to read Polar Express again.
Richard, I'm glad you're taking one for the team, because you know who's not going to read Polar Express?
Yeah.
Me. I'm
doing it so you don't have to, Kyle.
Perfect, perfect. Well, what I dig about this thing is we again, it is Witches Month, so it's spooky stuff all month long. Of course, perfect month to do our Tales from the Crypt episode. It wasn't until I started watching and then realizing, kind of looking at the difference between like the early 90s episodes, like the 1991 episodes and then the 95 episode, mm-hmm. like it's kind of an interesting survey course in Zemeckis's career and where it was, especially because the 95 episode, which we'll get to, is such a companion piece to Death Becomes Her in so many different ways.
Forrest Gump. And Forrest Gump.
Forrest Gump sort of goes without saying, which is interesting to do that a few years later after. Anyway, so, but yes, Richard, it's the Tales from the Crypt episode. We did it. It's October.
We did it. We got here. And just a little bit of background. I never grew up watching this show. So I had never seen any of these episodes. We never had HBO, and I was a scaredy cat as a kid. All I knew was the...
Wait, was this your very first Tales from the Crypt viewing experience?
You'd showed me Demon Knight like a decade ago, and that was my only Tales from the Crypt experience.
I have that Blu-ray around here somewhere. I actually grabbed it to put it on the desk. Oh, it fell. There it is.
Yeah, and yeah. I had always had this conception of Tales from the Crypt being, there he is, he's holding it up.
There you go.
Demon Knight. I had always had this conception of Tales of the Crypt as a really scary thing, mostly because the only images I had from my childhood were the puppet and its laugh. Mm-hmm. Those were the only things I knew as a kid, and I was terrified.
It's not the don't call it the fucking puppet.
Call it the fucking Crypt Keeper.
All right, the Crypt Keeper.
It's not the fucking puppet. So show respect.
That's all I knew of the show, so I was just terrified of the Crypt Keeper and his laugh, because that's all I knew. We never had HBO, and so this was something that was lost on me as a child. So it's fun to go back and be like, wait a second, this show is not overly scary at all.
If this and Demon Knight are your only sampling, like there are other much darker, much scarier episodes where things get, you know, where things are not quite as campy and as fun, and things get pretty brutal along the way. But that being said, it is all definitely through this lens of comedy and camp and sort of a comic book come to life. So it is this very heightened world. But there's definitely some. There's an episode where Kyle MacLachlan is trapped in the desert and gets handcuffed to a cop and has to drag him through and tries to hack his arm off to get free of him in a very 127 days, but things get really weird and brutal, and it definitely made an impression on me when I was a kid. So things get dark, but this was actually a very interesting slice of Tales from the Crypt episodes, because right off the bat, the Christmas episode and All Through the House, very kind of classic, iconic. It was one of the early episodes. It was definitely like season one, right?
It was episode two, actually.
Okay, cool.
The show came together with Walter Hill, Richard Donner, and Zemeckis kind of teaming up. And so they all launched an episode the first night. And this was the Zemeckis's.
No, that was... it's like... so that one, I feel, is very, very Tales from the Crypt, and then everything. Well, it's an interesting cut of episodes, because the other two definitely feel like increasingly kind of esoteric film experiments that kind of get further and further away from horror. But we kind of are right in it with this, with and All Through the House. And man, Again, it's one of those things that I remember that episode from when I was young. I enjoyed it. I enjoy seeing, what is his name? Dr. Giggles. Larry Drake. Yeah.
Darkman villain.
Yes, Darkman. Exactly. The guy who cuts the guy's fingers off in Darkman, yep. The cigarette cigar thing. Yeah.
That's a great scene.
Yeah. This is how affecting that scene is, the scene with the cigar thing is that where he cuts off the guy's fingers in Darkman. Is I remember that I watched that in like a motel room when we were just on like a road trip when we were kids and we were watching it on TV. I remember the setting and everything because it's just like that fired a lot of neurotransmitters. But anyway, so it was awesome. It like him as the deranged Santa Claus, the cool Silent Night, Deadly Night thing. It's a perfect Tales from the Crypt episode in that, and this is, we kind of touched on this a little bit with the Death Becomes Her episode, you know, which I guess is coming out right around the same time, but it's just, you have, of course, you know, your noirish crime where the person commits this terrible sin for personal gain. You know, we don't lean necessarily into the idea that, you know, that he's abusive or the abusive husband she kills or anything like that, though it's kind of implied. You know, instead she's, you know, trying to get money, and then she gets punished cosmically. And I actually really, and things that stood out this time was how magical a lot of her punishment seems, like when her keys sort of disappear into the snow and things fall, and every time she pushes it a little bit further, a door shuts, or some sort of cosmic punishment comes into play, which is really, really, really cool. And screenplay by Fred Decker of Monster Squad. Fred Decker is such an interesting dude. Monster Squad, Night of the Creeps, wrote and directed those. It was one of those guys who had like a profound impact with the movies he made, and yet was like adjacent to like the obviously like superlatively successful Shane Black, who he co-wrote Monster Squad with, and then he went on to do, you know, or was doing Lethal Weapon and all of that.
Right.
And yet Fred Decker, what was it? His big at bat directing wise was RoboCop 3, which did not do terribly well and didn't come together. From what I understand, I hope I'm remembering this correctly, but don't quote me. Didn't work out that well, that one. I remember when I was a kid, it was my least favorite of the three RoboCops, and I wonder if that just sort of stopped him from going on to do more things. Anyway, I love him as a writer. I love him writing this thing. It felt very, it felt very Zemeckis. That's what it felt like. You know,
it is so tight an episode.
Like, oh yeah, yeah.
So tight, and starting, and he even has his big opening shot where we see the well outside the window and we pan across all of the Christmas presents, and then let's talk about that.
So now we again see that opening shot, and again I don't want to get too caught up just talking about like about Dohickory, but kicked a cable. Anyway, but I don't want to get caught up talking about it. But again, we start with the Zemeckis, you know, long tracking shot that introduces all of the different objects that tell a little story.
The Santa cookies.
But what's interesting this time is that it has that show-off-y quality. That fantastic show-off equality of the other, like a shot at the beginning of Back to the Future, but it does it in a different way that's really clever and interesting, because it seems relatively sparse relative to the other shots, it seems sparse relative to the ones in the other other movies, and it's really about establishing this very homey Christmas vibe. Chestnuts roasting over an open fire is playing, you have, you know, Nat King Cole, you're starting the well, but you're subtly setting up many things, including even the song choice. Chestnuts roasting over an open fire, you get eventually to the fireplace. You see the note left for Santa, all that, and then you see her hand pick up the fire poker, and suddenly the song that you've been enjoying that so evokes this homey feeling of Christmas has now been subverted by the idea that the open fire over which the chestnuts would be roasting, presumably, is now the source of this fire poker. And what a gorgeous shot where the fire poker is raised to that angle where it seems to cut right across his neck from behind him, as it cuts through. It just lets you know. And it lets you know entirely just in the language of cinema. The fire poker's picked up. It's pointed at an aggressive angle away from the fire. It goes behind his neck. Everything you need to know is right there in that moment. And then like the shot has not done its most impressive thing yet. The coolest thing is this whole homey vibe that then is in, that is then subverted by this shot of the fire poker picking up, going through his neck. All of that is just to set up an elaborate magic trick where the one thing you're not expecting at the end of this long, 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 long shot that's full of lots of cool subtext is... Yeah. Like a literal switcheroo gag where like his head leans out of frame. We're not expecting it at all. It leans out of focus back into frame. It's been replaced by a dummy so that she can take the fire poker and drive it into his goddamn forehead. And what is his name? That the guy from Twins and Quado from Total Recall and fucking goddamn it. Anyway. You know, he has the baby come out of his belly and he's
Total
Recall. Yeah. That's Quado, the guy or the guy.
Quado.
Yeah,
has Quado.
And then I wish. And then he's in Twins. He's like, I have my driving gloves. I have my driving. I even have my driving hat, but I don't have my car. So there you go. I think he's married to like a famous costumer or wardrobe person who did like Barry Lyndon and stuff. I think
we'll look that up offline.
We'll look that up later.
Yes, I love that that's how that shot ends, that silly magic trick. I actually watched the original Tales from the Crypt movie from 72, Zemeckis was a huge fan of as a kid, which I think is part of the reason why he signed on. But that this kind of comic is adapted in that one as well, and you can almost see where he's picking up some of his stylistic tendencies, because that one opens with a big, long, similar shot, not as complicated, and ends with the same gag. Like immediately, it's in the comic, I also read. So it's very
similar. Rad. Then that's rad too. Then that adds a whole nother layer to it, which is fantastic. I need to look that up because I think I watched that once a long, long, long time ago, but I do not recall that at all. So I need to check that out.
Yeah, you can. It's very similar, actually, which is really cool to see. And that one has a really wonderful other gag. You can tell that he wanted to do something different on his gag, because that one, it's really great. He has a paper up in front of his face and she swings the thing and then goo flies in and hits the paper. So you see red hit it. But he does it one better and shows the fire poker being buried into somebody's skull, which is great. This is the detail that we're talking about the cast. This is the detail I just stumbled on before, which I think like explains a lot about his later filmography. The woman that's the lead in All Through the House was his wife at the time, which is interesting.
Yes, I know her. She's in a lot of good stuff.
Mary Ellen Trainor. She's the news reporter in Die Hard. She's the mom at the birthday party at the beginning of Ghostbusters. She's in the Lethal Weapon series as a psychiatrist. She's in Death Becomes Her. She's in Romancing the Stone. She's Mikey's mom in The Goonies. But he was married to her at the time. Mm-hmm. And here's where some theorizing comes in. They get divorced in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
The year 2000 is when Castaway and What Lies Beneath get released.
Mm-hmm.
So he's like doing two movies at once, and like he's talked about how he won an Oscar in his 40s, but he paid for it in his 20s, and he didn't have much of time for a personal life. And doing two movies again back to back seemed to have caused the relationship to scatter, which then leads us into the CG period. So he gets divorced, and then suddenly we're in Polar Express, Beowulf, Christmas Carol.
He crosses to the other side of the mirror. That's what,
right.
Just like the opening shot of the next episode that we're talking about.
Yeah.
Starring, which, by the way, I only vaguely... I didn't do much looking up before we started this, and I only vaguely remembered... the basic premise of You Murderer, but man, that was delightful. It's the kind of thing that I think I would have, as a kid, I would have probably thought there aren't enough monsters in this episode. That would have been, or not enough zombies. But again, all of the stuff, all of the, I don't know. Well, A, Humphrey Bogart. That's my last name, so I have that in connection with it. So I like it. I like it right away, Richard. I like it already. But you hadn't seen this one either, so
no,
did you know what you were in for with this whole thing, or did it come as a total surprise?
So I knew that they were resurrecting Bogart. I'd read that in the lead up to the episode, just kind of randomly. So I knew that they were going to do some of the stuff, and I think it's still surprisingly successful.
Yeah.
It actually,
even with the kind of cut and paste Photoshop Bogart heads that they kind of have in the reflections and everything.
Yes, but it's better than the CG Grand Moff Tarkin and Princess Leia. It works better than those things, which we're doing
you're
today.
Not, you know what? You're not wrong, Richard. You're not wrong. These early attempts at deepfakes done with scissors and sticks of glue are a little bit better somehow than those weird plastic faces. So I'll give you that.
Yeah, and so of course, it's Zemeckis, so I was pleasantly surprised with all of the mirror gags, like just the elevator shots and the doors opening and his reflection in the flask, and then the rearview mirror. It's like every possible mirror he shows up in, even ones you don't expect, which is really pleasant. But my favorite moment is when he gets that phone call in the beginning, and he looks in the mirror, and you have Bogart going, just a panicked
Well, let's not get ahead of ourselves. Set up what is the basic premise for... Okay, so the first episode was one of the early episodes. It's about, we're skipping right over the plots here. For the uninitiated, Richard, tell me, let's first about all through the night. We'll get back to Humphrey Bogart in a second. It's a Christmas episode. Zemeckis' wife at the time is trapped in the house. She kills a Zemeckis surrogate with a fire poker to the head. We can only presume.
Right.
She has to dispose of the body. Yes.
Somehow.
But the important thing is that a psychotic killer is on the loose, escaped from the local asylum, and that's the first thing I like about it is its purity.
Right.
It's just right down the middle. I love that.
It's very direct about it, and it comes on the radio as she's dragging the body out, which just talking about how to do exposition well. You have the dummy, like, it's on the radio, but she's also in the middle of her action of hiding the body and getting rid of it, so there's layers to the exposition with which works. She's got a daughter upstairs that's waiting for Santa Claus because it's apparently Christmas Eve. Mm-hmm. She's excited. We find out through that radio address that the killer is dressed in a Santa suit, so we know something weird is going to happen, and as she's trying to dispose of this body, she gets attacked and has to fend off an evil Santa.
It's remarkably efficient. They say he's going to be in a Santa suit, and then you know what shows up behind her? A guy who is unambiguously a crazy guy in a Santa suit.
Right.
No, nothing else required, Richard.
No,
he looks pretty
pulled.
Goddamn crazy. Like, pretty much right away, just to look at him. Plus, he tries to hit her with an axe. Both things. but what I dig is what makes it so... And actually, that's a good point to talk about. It's purity. It's quintessential Tales from the Cryptiness, just in that, the punishment fits the crime. In that, as she... It, like, literally... And this is what I really kind of dig about the way in which Zemeckis approaches it, and it's the same sort of thing we talk about in like the clock tower sequence in Back to the Future. There's this awareness of this sort of there's this awareness of this kind of karmic logic where you see characters' actions directly impacting whether or not the Plinko ball of fate sort of falls one way or the other, and he makes it very unambiguous in this movie where, like, as she's dragging the body, it's shaking the door closed, or as she's pulling him away, it's dropping her keys off of the thing, including literally dropping her keys and then them vanishing mysteriously into the snow. It's like, as she continues to do worse and worse shit, sort of karmically, she's just drawing all of this bad shit towards herself, and right up until the end where she gets locked literally in a closet and the doorknob falls out, she's trapped in. Yes. And so that her weird, perverse perversion of the Christmas holiday to take a life for gain ends up manifesting into a demon that is a perverse inversion of a piece of Christmas iconography that is there to take a life, in exchange for the one that she took. And I love that, of course, like the closet she gets trapped in has that window in it so you can see him scaling up past it and she has to get up there.
And that's a great shot where it just leads with the axe. Mm-hmm. The axe itself comes up first.
Yeah. But the one thing we needed is we needed that that sort of the final, like, should the, just her screaming her head off at the end, fine, but like I needed to see her severed head in a cake, or by that I mean like in a stocking, or like her limbs sticking out of a Christmas tree, all ornaments all over the tree. Like I needed that last little thing instead of the scream. But it was episode two. They didn't know how far they could go yet. Like were like, are people going to buy this?
Well, they were still. I mean, I think you can feel them. Like one of the things I read about the show is it kind of started to. It was kind of leading the tagline. It's not TV, it's HBO, and you can kind of feel them in this episode. Yeah. Like how far can we push everything? Yeah. And you get some of that with when she's standing over his dead body with the axe and closing her eyes, and you're teasing the audience: is she going to hack this guy to bits? Like, how far are they going to go here? Mm-hmm. I don't know. Which
it's kind of like the same line that like Netflix is trying to figure out right now, and it's like, can we put blood in Daredevil? And then they do, and they're like,
Does this
work?
This us? You
know, they're trying to figure it out. You know, but cool. Yeah, no, it was really fun to again. It's one of those we keep saying it over and over again, but very fun to revisit. I'm sure I have probably a half dozen times pulled out when I was in a Tales from the Crypt mindset. Pulled out a Tales from the Crypt DVD set that I have and watched that among other episodes and thought, man, weren't the '90s rad? But it was cool seeing it in this kind of Zemeckis continuum that we've been watching right now, and just see the evolution of that opening shot where now it's almost where what, you know, was originally made to kind of impress and carry this big expositional weight is now, you know, instead being used to kind of set up an elaborate gore joke, which sort of surprises you and sort of announces what the show is and is packed with all this cool subtext about the idea of Christmas, you know, the chestnuts roasting over the open fire, being flipped on its head, all that kind of stuff. And it just gives me a renewed, or just a different angle with which to look at this. So I don't know, really dug revisiting this one, maybe, you know, almost more than the others this time. Was really cool.
I mean, you've been talking about the moral universe of Robert Zemeckis all throughout the podcast. And while doing some research on this, I didn't know this. He went to his family was super religious, like Catholic. He went
it
to
comes
8 years
through
of, 8 years of Catholic school. So you've been talking about this for several episodes now, and to finally have that kind of, it's all about guilt and shame, and
yes,
and you get what's coming to you.
But I'll add a piece to that, which is, it's not just about the moral universe or like what is or is not good or bad or guilt associated with sex or any of those sorts of things, but it's the fact that. And I think this is maybe more of a Catholic thing, which is maybe seeing the world. It's you know, if you're Catholic, you grew up, you know, taking like eating like wafers and drinking wine and all of this, and it's very ceremonial. So there's a slightly more magical worldview, there's maybe a bit more of a view that, you know, there is a direct relationship between your actions and then whether or not, you know, you lock your keys in the car. And certainly if you exist in that mindset for a long time, you begin to think and begin to kind of see that cinema itself is sort of a reflection of that same logic. I'm going to go deep here. I'm reading that new book, Immortality Key, which is kind of talks about ancient religions and their links to psychedelics. Check it out, kids. It's very cool. But they talk about how the Eleusinian rituals and like the Dionysian festivals and everything, which were the biggest religious festivals of the year, where, you know, we're like a lot of wine and stuff was drunk. We were now thinking it might be spiked with psychedelic components from or derived from ergot and all sorts of cool stuff. Check it out, kids. Cool book. But that they viewed, like, that when we're talking about the Greeks and we're talking about theater, they viewed religion and theater as the same thing. This is this point that was trying to be made, like the idea of putting actors together and characters together and having them manifest. And by the way, a lot of the biggest celebration, this is perfect, would have been the kind of Day of the Dead, Halloween. It's sort of, there's an echo of these pagan rituals still today. It's Witches Month, guys. See how Witches I'm tying Month. It in? I'm tying this into ancient stuff, Richard. That's
Good.
What I'm
Keep
bringing
going.
To
Keep
this
going,
podcast.
Kyle!
But what's cool about it is the idea that, like, manifesting these dramas, like Sophocles writing a drama, these plays, creating these little moral universes while possibly imbibing, you know, wine and psychedelics and with a strong religious conviction that you're communing with the dead. That these were conjurings of a sort, that they were the idea of, like, creating these characters and kind of indulging maybe in the spiritual world, especially during this time of year, was simultaneously a feature of their religion and a deep feature of their religious practice, but maybe also a deep feature of the origins of drama, the origins of the movies that we watch. And so it's interesting to look at Spielberg and his religious convictions and Zemeckis and his, and see, and even, you know, much earlier than that, people like John Ford, and see how part, I think, of the strength of the why, you know, character and theme and motif and everything holds together and reinforces what they're trying to do so strongly is because in their minds, you know, and you know, they exist in a moral universe that functions spiritually in a way that is analogous, and not accidentally, like historically analogous to thinking about angels and gods and mythic stories and using those to sort of communicate moral ideas and all sorts of things. And so what I'm saying, Richard, is now in the month of October, as we approach all of these Dionysian festivities that are coming up, and, you know, and probably some people are going to take drugs. I'm saying it might happen. I don't know.
Probably
it's important
me.
To remember. It's important to remember that if you do that and you watch a film like, say, The Witches or whatever, that you are indeed potentially, you know, kind of getting a little fucked up and watching The Witches, you're potentially participating in a tradition that goes back thousands and thousands of years. And I'm saying that Robert Zemeckis knows that. And that is, I think, part of why the moral universe and his religion and his Catholicism, I think, informs and gives strength to his stories, just in terms of they that's why they hold together so damn well, because he has a very clear idea of how the world fits together.
Yeah,
Richard,
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
So you're saying, like, just there's a very strong tie then in what you said between these films and the media we absorb, and religion.
The big point I'm trying to say is that what if cinema, Richard, what if cinema is innately spiritual? And so the spiritual among us, I mean, look at Scorsese and his Catholicism,
yep.
Zemeckis and his stuff. I mean, there's a lot of spirituality in Spielberg. What if the medium is inherently spiritual? And that's why so many of our, and here's the question, chicken and egg question, Richard, chicken and egg question.
Yeah.
If the medium is inherently spiritual, is it those who are spiritual who come to it and therefore thrive within that medium, or is it mastering this medium that causes them to become more spiritual, even deeper into adulthood? Because certainly Scorsese still seems to be interested in Catholic shit, Richard. Think about it.
Yeah, I would assume the latter, I think. No, the former. Mm. The one where the spiritual people, like...
You would think wouldn't you?
Well, yes, of course I would.
You Flanders mustache son of a bitch.
I would think that. Well,
you are looking very Flanders right now. Are you going to dress as Flanders for Halloween?
Yeah, I got to order the glasses and the sweater.
Nice.
That's thing
rad.
Today. I'm gonna shave the stubble around and practice my heidely hoedly neighborinos and see what we can do.
Eventually, we'll post the video component of these so that Richard, we can all see Richard's mustache.
It's gonna be tough.
It's right there.
There you go.
That's why I have the mic in front of it to hide it, because I'm still lightly ashamed of it.
You should be.
As I should be.
It's a strong mustache, Richard.
I thank you, Kyle. That makes me feel.
I mean, is it as strong as, say, my mustache? No, but it's a strong mustache.
You have, like,
I'm secure enough in my follicular density to compliment yours.
Yes, but are you secure enough to go with just the mustache?
No, I don't want to look like a creepy perv.
We have derailed ourselves so hard,
Richard,
here.
Richard, my beard is so strong in every area. The cheeks, the chin, it's so strong everywhere that I can't shave it down. You know, I would be depriving the world of some little patch of Eden right here on my cheek.
Patch of Eden. That's great,
that's right.
Kyle. final thoughts on and All Through the House. Just a few things. It's shot by Dean Kundi, who shot most of his big stuff.
Yeah, shot by Dean Cundey, music by Alan Silvestri, just all top shelf folks.
Yeah, and it starts. I guess you can answer this question better than I can. But in all these, just talking about blurring the lines between TV and movies, having the bigger stars in some of these, John Lithgow in the later one, Kirk Douglas in Yellow, like introducing big Hollywood names into the small screen onto television, and also using opening credits like movies. Like they all open with the titles, the big titles, the name of the movie, directed by, the cast, and like you get Silvestri's name in there, Cundey's name in there. It just feels like a movie, and for that reason alone. And then you
that's a good point, actually. It is every bit. It's interesting to see cinema, because we think about, we're living in a golden age of TV now. We're like, oh, there's a lot of money put into TV, but you're not really seeing cinema that sophisticated on TV. You're seeing long series of television happening, but you're not seeing kind of that much energy poured into that many minutes, and you really feel it. It feels much more like a movie than TV. You know what, Richard? It's not TV. It's HBO.
It's HBO. Well, what's really interesting, too, because I watched Bordello of Blood for the first time last night, just to kind of get a sense of what that was. Because Zemeckis and Bob Gale had...
How was that, Richard? Did you enjoy watching Bordello of Blood for the first time?
Yes. Yes. And I think even looking at something like that, talking about at least the cinema qualities of these three episodes, are far and away more cinematic than Bordello of Blood.
Oh, my
far
God. Yeah,
and
yeah,
away
yeah.
more.
Oh, that goes without saying, yeah. But,
well, it's interesting, though, because that's supposed to have more money behind it and is playing in multiplexes and stuff. And then you have Zemeckis episodes, at least, that are reading as
in fairness,
cinema.
I have a feeling that Zemeckis' episode of Tales from the Crypt cost more than Bordello of Blood. I'm just going to guess. It was a different time.
Maybe. I don't know. Who knows? Yeah.
Who knows? I don't know. But that's certainly how it looks. But is it worth talking about all the complicated history with all the movies that were going to be... We touched on it on the Death Becomes Her, because Bordello of Blood has some complicated relationship, which I've heard a couple different versions of, with From Dusk Till Dawn. From Dusk Till Dawn was one of my favorite movies growing up, but apparently was at some point going to be a Tales from the Crypt movie, but then broke off and it was now something else. And then, like, the script for Bordello of Blood, which clearly shares some similar elements to From Dusk Till Dawn, was sort of generated to kind of backfill that in some way. That's one version of it I heard, but again, I'm not 100% sure exactly what that relationship is. And then beyond that, there was Frighteners was going to be a Tales from the Crypt movie. Death Becomes Her might have been a Tales from the Crypt movie. All of which, by the way, would have greatly enhanced
the Tales
people's
from the
ability.
Crypt name.
Well, yes, the Tales from the Crypt name, but I honestly, in both instances... Especially with, you know, in both instances, we talk about how, man, the marketing of Frighteners did a lot to obscure that it was a horror movie, which was a delightful discovery when I was a kid. And I as a little Fangoria subscriber as a kid walking in, I'm like, holy shit, there's gore and ghosts and shit in this movie. You know, it was a surprise in the theater. It was delightful. But both films, I feel, would have benefited from being framed as Tales from the Crypt movies. And I wonder, again, is that an artifact from that time where people just thought there was such a class separation between TV and a film that, you know, they didn't want, that like, it kind of lowers it if it bears the Tales from the Crypt name. I don't know. But the one thing we did get, Richard, is Demon Knight, and I'm holding the Blu-ray right now, and it's goddamn great. And I thought it was the coolest thing, man, when I was a kid. I really did. I thought it was the Crypt Keeper. He was in a movie. You know, it has William Sadler, everything I wanted. Demons, Billy Zane. Yeah,
always loved the Billy Zane. I read a little bit about the Bordello of Blood script. Apparently, Zemeckis and Gale wrote a version of it in the late 70s, like as they were trying to break into to Hollywood, which, like, given it's vampires and boobs,
makes sense.
That sounds like something they would write. Apparently, that's what endeared them to John Milius. That and another script. John Milius said that the script was pretty darn good, in addition to another one. That led them to 1941. And if you think back on us saying, oh, it's socially irresponsible cinema, like Bordello of Blood fits pretty strongly within that.
Yeah.
So that's what that, and then the kind of other piece to it, when the after Demon Knight, it was going to be a trilogy of movies, and they were trying to figure out what the second one was, which is, I think, where Dusk Till Dawn comes in, and probably The Frighteners as well. Zemeckis was being courted by DreamWorks to have a contract through DreamWorks. He was at Universal at the time, I believe, and Bordello of Blood got made to keep him at Universal. It was decided that they would choose that script, rewrite it, which is probably why it shares some similarities to From Dusk Till Dawn, because that that was like almost a thing. And somebody was probably like, oh, well, if we just add these elements that were cool in that movie, here suddenly we have something that's cool. So I think that sounds like it's probably what happened, but it was a pure like business studio play to select Bordello of Blood to keep Zemeckis
interesting
in that system. I don't know if that's interesting to anybody, but
no, and I find it fascinating. I just wish that I wish that there had been a few more cinematic at bats with the Crypt Keeper there, and I wish that he had been attached to something like The Frighteners or something like, From Dusk Till Dawn is kind of a perfect thing as is, just leave it alone. But attached to something like The Frighteners or even Death Becomes Her, Jesus, like it would have been such a wonderful framing device for Death Becomes Her that I wish that as opposed to his only, the Crypt Keeper's only appearance other than Demon Knight being, what is it?
Bordello of Blood.
Yeah. Which, it is what it is. So Dennis Miller's in it.
Dennis Miller's in it, which he's not bad. I like the kind of... there's a lot of things I like.
Is he not bad?
He's not bad.
Is he not bad, Richard?
He's not bad.
And, what was her name? Angie Everhart, who played... Angie Everhart, is that her name?
Yeah.
Oh, man. That was a deep pull. I have not thought of that name in 10 years. Just got it. She is also...
in it.
She is also in the film. No, she is very she is very attractive.
She's very... very attractive.
A vampire in the film.
I liked Corey Feldman in it. Like, that was fine.
Right, you watched it last night, didn't you? How was that?
Yeah, I mean, it was fine.
Yeah.
I just wanted to see if I could pick out what Zemeckis, if any of Gale and Zemeckis was still in there, what parts would it be? And, man, apart from the boobs and the vampire brothel, I don't know.
Which is an important part of both the history of Zemeckis and Gale and of Bordello of Blood. So,
It's fine.
All right. Oh, and let's move on to the
minister. The minister makes sense given his 8 years of Catholic school.
Actually, it sounds like we're really dumping on Bordello of Blood. I actually don't feel that strongly in the negative about it. I just honestly, it's been so long since I visited. I have nothing to say because it has been a while since.
Well,
I came
out of these episodes in Demon Knight excited about Tales from the Crypt, and I came out of Bordello of Blood being like, I get why this kind of sapped all the energy out of it.
There is so much more for you to discover in Tales from the Crypt, Richard.
Yeah,
and lots of episodes. We'll do a full rewatch.
Before we dive into Yellow, I think it's interesting. Like, you brought up an interesting point via text. This isn't streaming on HBO right now, which is surprising.
I thought that was funny because I remember you were saying, I was concerned, like, hey, where are we going to watch these things? And I know I have the DVDs somewhere, but I've boxed up a lot of my DVDs and I only have a small amount of them out, and searched through, couldn't find them, and the DVDs that I even have are, I think, incomplete. I have two little sets. It may be season one and two, but I don't know if it would have the later episodes. So yeah, we ended up just finding them on YouTube, watching them there. It's the only place we could figure out how to watch them. So
yeah, there's some rights issue that's keeping them from streaming. But I found it very strange that like that's a key piece of
that did not
old
surprise
HBO.
Me. Yeah, it did not surprise me in the sense that they've never been readily available. This never really been readily available for streaming for whatever reason. Once HBO, Go started, and then HBO Now, and then HBO Max, at various times I remember having looked up, Tales from the Crypt. Oh, maybe now Tales from the Crypt, and looked for it and just been disappointed. Cool to have the DVDs around wherever they are now. So it was interesting. So to move on to You
Yellow.
Murderer.
Oh,
no, well, we haven't really... I guess You Murderer is the last chronologically, so...
Right. I mean, we can jump to that if you want.
Let's absolutely talk about Yellow. Yellow is obviously Paths of Glory, but with Kirk Douglas as the bad guy.
Right.
And one of the lesser Douglases
as this,
as the lead,
as his pathetic son.
Yes, yes, exactly. What's his name? I forgot his name.
Eric Douglas.
Eric Douglas. Is he the one? I think he's in The Golden Child. He plays like one of the biker gangs. Like I used to watch the movie The Golden Child a lot when I was
I don't know.
Young.
And, I've only saw it the one time you showed me, and Eric Douglas was not on my radar until like yesterday when I watched this again.
Yeah, Yellow is, again, I'm torn because at the same time, as a now looking at it with adult eyes, I'm like, wow, it's amazing that they were able to capture like Kirk Douglas is amazing in it. This is sort of just before he had his stroke. Also, if you want to see some latter day Kirk Douglas, that's kick ass. Watch the movie Greedy, him and Michael J. Fox. Come on, you can't beat that. But then he had his stroke shortly thereafter, so it was really cool seeing him. It's obviously the whole film is set during World War One, and it is, you know, it is, you know, it's entirely playing in the pool of iconography, or almost entirely playing in the pool of iconography from Stanley Kubrick's Paths of Glory, starring Kirk Douglas. It's, you know, all about cowardice and people being put up for a firing squad. But it's about him and his yellow son, played by his actual son, Eric Douglas. Lance Henriksen basically plays Kirk Douglas in this movie, which is pretty rad. Him just going around and sounding like this. Lance Henriksen
God
is great in everything.
Damn!
Yeah,
he's so
wonderful. He's yellow! He's yellow, sir!
Yes, like, exactly. His performance is perfect.
What's cool is that like I was watching the movie, I was watching the episode and like vibing and almost kind of spiritually thinking of Lance Henriksen as like this surrogate for Kirk Douglas, and then he walks in and then there's real Kirk Douglas and they're just Kirk Douglasing at each other hard. And I'm like, fuck yeah. And then you know what they needed? Michael Douglas.
We
didn't get that. We got Eric Douglas, and again, I'm not ripping on Eric Douglas. He actually did a rad job. I think that the main thing that began to unravel for me in this episode is that it's like a 40-minute high budget Tales from the Crypt episode, but I know as a kid I would have fucking hated this fucking episode of Tales from the Crypt.
There's no monsters.
Yeah, you have all this money, and I get like now all of the things from an adult perspective, I see all of these things in constellation with each other.
Right.
EC comic books, you know, weird war stories, crime stories, noir stories, horror stories, it all, you know, generically feels of a piece, and yet, you know, the early 90s was a period where there wasn't a lot of horror going on, especially with that much money being thrown at it, especially as accessible as HBO and all of that. If you were subscribed to Fangoria at the time, you were reading about movies to a large extent that were going to be opening at your local video store. You were reading about like Charles Band movies and that sort of thing, Full Moon Productions. And so, and then if like you were reading about a movie in the 90s in Fangoria that was going to be opening big, it was like The Relic or Seven, just very not as much. So you wanted to see horror, and Tales from the Crypt, I was excited. It literally opens with a goddamn zombie skull monster in the basement of a dark castle full of woo-ah sounds, you know, saying hello kitties, and then green slime, and you know how much we loved green slime in the 90s. It was
a big deal all over Nickelodeon.
Everything was green slime back then.
Slimer?
Yeah, and this would have been one of those episodes where I would have been, again, streaming didn't exist. You're there. You're it's late at night. You make it to the television. You change to HBO somehow because, you know, it was how you found out what was on TV, Richard. Remember how
you
that
changed
worked?
The channel. Yeah.
And then boom, you're just there. You're hearing Danny Elfman's music. You're spiraling down the stairs. You're like, fuck yes, I did it. I don't understand how time works or scheduling at all as a child. So like, it was just pure luck, you know? And then an episode would start and I could just feel like the kid in me die. And again, Lance Henriksen from Aliens, badass. Kirk Douglas, badass. Love all that war.
Dan Aykroyd. Dan Aykroyd is in it.
Aykroyd. By the way, we need to talk about the whole thing. By the way, all the secret magic stuff that's hidden in all of Spielberg and Zemeckis' stuff, it's definitely coming from Dan Aykroyd. He's studying ancient aliens. He's studying Egypt. He's crystal skulls. He's the one who's feeding them all this stuff. And that's why he shows up. He shows up in 1941. He shows up in Indiana Jones. He shows up here. He's there. He's an important part of it. But anyway, And then all I would have been doing is just waiting for like zombie soldiers or something, and the episode would have gone on and on, and then it would have disintegrated into those monologues about cowardice, and my little heart would sink as I would realize that we were just wrapping up. And again, I get the sick joke, like the twisted joke, of course, is that in Paths of Glory, it's this whole thing about like this, you know, empathy for these soldiers who are basically being made example of because a power mad commander sends them up a hill to die, and so they refuse. Right. And Kirk Douglas is trying to defend them, and now, of course, Kirk Douglas is the mustache twisting villain who is sending his own son to die and telling him they're going to load the gun with blanks. Spoiler alert! just so that he will die with the appearance of bravery. He betrays his own son. It's an awesome rad joke, but I would have loved it if that were the opening scene of the goddamn thing. If like that were the opening scene, and then all the soldiers rose up as zombies and they got him, uh-huh. We'd be like, oh my god, he betrayed his son. It's like this crazy
and
inversion of Paths of Glory.
Yeah.
Yes, it's amazing. They managed to turn Paths of Glory completely on its head in 4 minutes. Thank God we have the remaining 18 minutes of this episode for zombies to show up. And instead, right. And again, at the same time, now as an adult, I'm also watching it and marveling, like, holy shit. Kirk Douglas was still so fucking good at that age. God damn it. He would have made more movies if it hadn't been for the stroke. He would have continued to be good. This is rad. And yet, again, it was a cool episode. I dig that probably, you know, it's him and he's acting with his son. It's about that whole thing. It's about the... There's no way it would have happened if not for the fact that it was about a father and son arguing with each other about expectations and all of that. The episode wouldn't exist if it weren't that. I get that. I understand how the world works. But at the same time, if they just sort of got that out of the way in the first 4 minutes, boom, 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 he gets dead, and then all the soldiers covered in that white powder, maybe? Remember how like they're all covered in lye because they're all in the thing?
They all rise up,
and they all look like Japanese ghosts, and they come after Kirk Douglas, and he's like, ah! And then they tear him apart, and then he's in a Christmas tree, just like, or in a stocking, what's her bitch at the, should be at the end of the first one. I'm telling you, man, that's a Tales from the Crypt episode.
Well, what's interesting, like, it's so interesting that that's your reaction, and I totally probably would have had that same reaction if I had seen it when I was younger and was more familiar with the show. I was actually shocked at how it was none of those things and how it still held together, and it felt like him stepping into a space where he's making stuff that's not overt comedy and it's not overt scary. It's like this actual... pristinely functioning drama that exists, which he, like, if you look back on his career, like, this is kind of a new step for him. Coming right after this, he shot this after Back to the Future 3 before Death Becomes Her, so it's like baby steps in towards, or not even baby steps, it's like the piece I think works great. So I love the piece. It was my favorite of the three.
Alternately, imagine this. He falls into the grave. All those people are there. Then he goes away. Guess who overheard the conversation? Freaky-ass Dan Aykroyd. Because we know that Dan Aykroyd is into magic and aliens and shit. He reaches into his bag. He pulls out, what a crystal skull.
Skull.
Richard.
Yes!
We are like at minute 5 into this episode. Dan Aykroyd has a crystal skull. He invokes Kabbalistic magic, okay? He channels energy into Tiphereth, and then he raises the dead using black, you know, inverted pyramids and stuff. We know that Dan... Listen, Dan Aykroyd in real life probably knows how to do this, Richard. I'm fairly certain that Dan Aykroyd is a powerful wizard, possibly also an alien. Okay,
wizard,
so
alien.
He would be able. Think about, he's handcuffed right now, Richard. He's handcuffed in this episode, just playing a soldier. If he were allowed to pull out a crystal skull again and do deep, like, Kabbalistic magic rituals, we're talking like minute 5, 6, and 7 of the episode. There's an act break somewhere in there.
Sure.
Then all zombies covered in lye powder with their creepy dead black eyes, you know, that look like, and then they're like, ah, we're covered in white powder. It would be creepy. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
They'd stand out against the black backdrop of the night, Richard.
This is what's interesting. I mean, this leads it to something I found really interesting, at least on the three that we watched, is I read the comics for each of these, and the first one is a pretty direct adaptation. There's not too many changes mm-hmm. that they obviously made a lot of smart little tweaks to make the thing mm-hmm. play better. But in terms of how the story starts and ends and the beats in between, it's almost the exact same. Same with this one, actually. There's not any war stuff. Like, they're not on the battlefield ever. It's just them in the rooms. And it's pretty faithful in terms of how it presents that comic story as an adaptation. And it's in a war comics thing. This actually didn't start as a Tales from the Crypt episode. It started as it was shot for a pilot for something called Two-Fisted Tales, which is why there's this weird Two-Fisted Tales thing on his IMDb. It was shot for a war anthology series with that he was trying to get off the ground with Donner in parallel.
That makes to Tales from so the Crypt. Much more sense.
Yeah. And it played on Fox Pass because it played to zero fanfare. Like, nobody cared. The project died, and like all three of those segments that they shot for those were repurposed as Tales from the Crypt episodes,
which is why
this one is it's the only double episode in Tales from the Crypt, apparently. And it's because of that.
I'm just saying that's
I'm
fine.
Not disagreeing.
Tales from the Crypt episode. If it had gone full Qui-Gon at the end and Japanese ghosts started showing up and boxing in a Kirk Douglas, come on, man, it would have been fucking rad. It just, yeah. So that's all I'm saying. You can picture it, Richard.
I can picture it. I don't think it's wrong, but in terms of an adaptation, I think they did a pretty stellar job. And in terms of just this piece as a World War One piece, which originally it was a World War Two piece, like in the comic, it's World War Two. They made it World War One to match Paths of Glory.
Mm-hmm.
But just thinking about this piece as a World War One piece is so much better a World War One piece than even 1917. It's shot. It's doing a lot of long takes, just like 1917, but just better. It's just better.
Yeah, because it's real, Richard.
Because it's real.
Because it's real. They're all really there.
And it just, the differences to my mind are staggering. I wasn't a huge fan of 1917.
I haven't watched it yet, or the
cinematography of 1917. I feel like it's a technical thing, but it does nothing for the story. Absolutely, it's a distraction.
Wait, Richard, are you saying that the cinema of Robert Zemeckis is more spiritual, and that he is not, in fact, the pure mechanist that everyone accuses him of being?
Yes.
That's what I'm saying.
Correct. And the opening segment of this, like, even if there's not zombies, you have to look at the opening of this with the World War One stuff, with bodies flying and smoke everywhere and pulling back from the flower, and then Lance Henriksen, just his series of dams and the arm coming off.
You know what this? You know what it felt like to me? It felt like a Two-Fisted Tale is what it felt like to me. That is the perfect way to describe it, and that makes so much more sense. I'm glad that I know that now, because it also enables me to really appreciate it for what it was, that it was made for it to be exactly the right thing for what it was supposed to be, and the decision to put it on Tales from the Crypt, I get it. I understand now. It got it out there. But at the same time, young Kyle Bogart, very disappointed that there were no zombies.
I feel that. Yeah. Also, Silvestri's score on this, really, really effective. The whole drum thing at the end, super tense, right before the firing squad. The whole overture over the yellow flower and opening credits is wonderful.
And the flower gets like hit with a body falling, right?
Yeah, exactly.
At the beginning. Yeah.
And it pulls back into this huge, what 1917 tried to do, of go from the micro to the macro about what the war was. It does it in that opening shot with a big stunt, some guy getting hit with a grenade and flying, flipping over, landing in a puddle of water. So good. And worth noting, we'll talk about this on the Forrest Gump episode, but he changed cinematographers mid-career. Dean Kundi, the last film he shot with him was Death Becomes Her. This one, Don Burgess, who I'd never heard of before, but first one out of the gate was this, and then Forrest Gump, and then literally everything to date. He even did The Witches. So
it
will be interesting to see if there's any visual differences. I couldn't tell any on the TV episode, but may have some stuff in there too. But
speaking of Forrest Gump.
Speaking of Forrest Gump, you want to jump into You Murderer?
Yes, I do. Well, so to talk about, there's a lot of delightful. So we're talking, we're just jumping forward in time to 95, and there's so much just creamy 90s goodness in this. It opens with the feather, the literal feather from Forrest Gump.
Not just the feather, but the score done on the harpsichord in a horror horror theme.
Yes, 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 yes. And the theme from Forrest Gump. And then, of course, we have our opening with with the Crypt Keeper.
Fearest Gump.
Yes, yes, yes. Fearest Gump. So I guess so. Zemeckis is coming right off the bat of having done this big family friendly. It is, or at least that's the idea, or Oscar, like beloved Oscar winning, best picture winning film.
What's interesting before we get into it winning Oscars is this was released before.
That was going to be my next question.
Yeah,
It
was released even before the Oscar nominations were announced.
Nice.
Which is kind of a big, like, this is my dick on the table.
Well, he doesn't say anything about winning an Oscar or anything. Like, it was already a big hit and a beloved film by that point.
At the end, the Crypt Keeper says there's got to be an easier way to get an Oscar.
That's funny. That's funny. I get it in the sense that there's probably a discourse surrounding people like him and Spielberg wanting Oscars and, you know, not getting them and yada yada yada.
What it reminded me of was I don't know if you've seen it, Spielberg reacting to the Oscar nominations for Jaws.
I watched that years ago. I think I watched it in film school. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's so good to just see a young Spielberg be frustrated when he doesn't get nominated for Best Director. Because it's wonderful.
It's one of those good lessons where, and you know that, like, you realize that also, by the way, makes 1941 make sense in relationship to Raiders of the Lost Ark. You see that there is this he's channeling really powerful magic. He has all of this talent, you know, all of this whatever he's doing, but he needed to mature through these experiences to eventually arrive at Raiders of the Lost Ark. Yeah, but what I always think about that, because there's that idea that, you know, if you're not at peace, if you have not settled that internal tumult, you can sort of make a hell out of any situation. And then we think about, like, during the quarantine, they started renting out private theaters here in Austin. So we rented out a theater, me and my brother Cliff, we rented out a theater to do to show Duel. And we were like, God, imagine just making, we watched Duel and we play with some buds. And we were thinking about making Jaws after this, and we were thinking about, like, God, can you imagine just in your 20s just making something that was as successful as Jaws and blah, 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 blah. And then you look at a clip like that and you realize it does, even if you're superlatively successful, you know, you can still be really frustrated and confused because it's your 20s and, like, still feel slighted and still be working shit out and still not feel like you're having a good time because it's your 20s. And then eventually you grow up a little bit more.
The world isn't giving you what you deserve.
Exactly. At any scale. It doesn't matter.
At any scale,
the world is always not giving you what you deserve. It was definitely the case.
At Spielberg with Jaws and that announcement, I mean, it's just... Yes, he there was still something that the world owed him at that point. And also, if the listeners haven't seen Ruben Östlund's reaction video for not getting nominated for Force Majeure.
But oh, my God. Yeah,
that is a brilliant...
That's really good. And if you have not seen his film, The Square, great. And if you have not seen that guy from The Square starring in the BBC Dracula that the guys who made Sherlock did, you should also see that. That's a whole lot of viewing I'm recommending right there. Hours of entertainment.
Well, they're all excellent.
And all available on streaming, probably.
The lead in The Square is phenomenal.
What is that guy's name? He's rad. He's a perfect Dracula in that
series. Klaus Bang.
His name is Klaus?
Klaus, oh, man. Or Klaus, it's Klaus or Klaus or
perfect.
Klaus.
So he was born to play it.
And his last name is Bang.
Nice. They need to get, if they make a season two of that, they should get Werner Herzog on there playing another older, creepier vampire. No makeup required.
Yeah,
just Werner.
Anything with Werner in it is worth
it. It's like, okay, Werner. Werner's on his way from makeup. I'm sorry? To makeup. Oh. He's on his way to makeup. that was a PA talking into a radio, Richard. You see?
I saw it. I got it.
I was touching my ear, and it doesn't matter because it's an audio medium. So,
well, at least we're narrating what you're doing while you're doing it.
That's true.
That's how radio works. You murderer. So we talked about the Forrest Gump intro. We've got this kind of crazy first-person perspective thing where...
It is a film entirely from the POV of a character who is Humphrey Bogart, looks into mirrors, reflects back the reflection of Humphrey Bogart, which is achieved with very similar effects to Forrest Gump. To Forrest Gump. And we very even similar, see that that connection is made in the framing device in the intro with the Crypt Keeper, who looks to his right and sees Alfred Hitchcock. You know,
which also
Alfred
looks
Hitchcock.
Great.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it looks, it, yes, no, I agree. It definitely looks better than plastic face CGI versions of people. So, yes, Alfred Hitchcock looks at him. So it's kind of connecting Forrest Gump now to, hey, we're going to Forrest Gump some horror. Check it out. And then we jump right into it. You know, Richard, that's what we need to do. That's how we open every episode.
Let's jump in.
Oops, sorry, I'm adjusting my levels. A little hot.
Gonna make a note of that.
There you go. But we gump into every episode from now on. But other cool things about this, in addition to being a POV episode from the POV of Humphrey Bogart, that is to say, you know, it's kind of like the Christopher Walken skit, The Continental, but imagine a guy mm-hmm. doing a Humphrey Bogart impression from, like, Play It Again, Sam, the whole time. So kind of walking around as this, like, ad guy in this big corporate boardroom at the beginning. And again, we see this interesting thing where they're turning "Here's Looking at You, Kid" into a ad slogan. So he directly sort of confronts the idea of, like, is this a soulless or exploitative act to occupy and to literally to boldly say starring Humphrey Bogart at the beginning right. of the episode. And so he directly kind of addresses that by having us say that, all right, this it's "Here's Looking at You, Kid," and the "you" is a lamb, and then "Here's Looking at You, Kid," it's a goat. And then we realize he's looking at you, kid. And we realize now we're confronting that same idea, and we're now, like, introducing these weird, somewhat, like, almost biblical animals, like a sheep and a goat yeah. and a hare, and again, just weird stuff. That's again, like, there's a potency, man, to the first 6 or so minutes of any Robert Zemeckis thing, where you just want to look it at, because it's very interesting and layered. And the girl he's having an affair with is dressed all in red, and he's yep. fucking Humphrey Bogart at the same time. You know, so that's a whole weird thing you're processing. It's all a POV. And then we jump in where it's announced Sunset Boulevard style, of course, that he is dead at the beginning. The opening shot is him looking into what, of course, a mirror, which simultaneously serves the utilitarian purpose of identifying that he is, in fact, a picture of Humphrey Bogart that was cut out of a magazine. and that he is dead. And what do we see yet again, as in Death Becomes Her, as in all the other stuff? How do we represent that world between? How do we, in our hyper-meta, cinematically aware Zemeckisian world, how do we represent that barrier between the living and the dead? We do it with a mirror.
So not just one mirror, like a series of increasingly absurd mirrors.
Oh, so many mirrors. But he puts it on Front Street right away by having him be in a car looking into a rear-view mirror and saying, like, I am dead. Which means, that what are we seeing on screen? We're seeing Humphrey Bogart on the other side of a screen, on the other side of a screen. So it's basically letting you know that, yes, this is innately contains a metatextual element. We're seeing him on the other side of a screen announcing, yes, I am dead. I am Humphrey Bogart. I will be your narrator and the star of this film, or the star of this movie. How do you feel about that? And then, like, right when you're like, I'm not sure I feel about it, what are they going to do? Like, have him say, "Here's looking at you, kid," and, like, then winking at the camera. And then they turn it into a literal ad slogan a moment later as he looks into mirror after mirror. So that's fucking rad. And then Isabella Rossellini. I mean, we're not even talking about that. Talk about being connected to Death Becomes Her. Talk about being connected to Death Becomes Her. You have her, you know, playing her mom, but a weird, perverted, inverted version of her mom, dressed in the same costumes, but she's just, like, killing motherfuckers. And
delivering the same lines in you have to do the thinking for the both of us. And what is it? Kiss me like it's the last time.
Yeah, clearly the strangest decision and the moment that sort of stands out is the decision to introduce a rad John Lithgow, who is always rad, in full Raising Cain mode. Mm-hmm. Rad John Lithgow as the plastic surgeon who, quote unquote, made him look like Bogart. And I'm wondering, what the because it's like the thing kind of works is this cool evocation of Humphrey Bogart as if it sort of is him. It says starring Humphrey Bogart, and yet then it acknowledges like within the diegesis Humphrey Bogart exists, and he has now had plastic surgery to look like right. him to escape from saying some kind of a past. So obviously that peels back a particular veil. So it says this is really isn't about Humphrey Bogart being dead, which I like because it makes the metatextual element a little bit more symbolic rather than literal, which is interesting. But again, in a movie about Isabella Rossellini, where we have Isabella Rossellini and it's about, you know, old Hollywood, and it's so similar in many ways to Death Becomes Her, it just feels like another thing that I seem to have lost my train of thought, Richard. Oh, but there's a lot right. of lot right. of oh sorry the plastic surgery element that was right. what I was that was building up to is that John Lithgow is a plastic surgeon
named
evil
Oscar.
Plastic surgeon named Oscar. Oh right. Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, which cool. is why they end the episode with there's got to be an easier way to get an Oscar.
See, that's what happens when I watch these things quickly. You're again, good. By the way, this is another point. Watching John Lithgow in being directed by Zemeckis, it just makes me wish that there had been a lot more Lithgow and Zemeckis
That is how I felt about Dan Aykroyd.
Yeah.
Because thinking back, Dan Aykroyd is great in the Yellow episode.
Mm-hmm.
He's also great in 1941, which is directed by Spielberg. But you kind of get it with him rattling off just information about military stuff. It just is. Yeah. It works so good.
It was great because as soon as Dan Aykroyd gets on screen, they immediately start giving him Dan Aykroyd lines. And Dan Aykroyd lines in every fucking movie are like him just spouting technical jargon, whether it's in Raiders of the Lost Ark or it's in Ghostbusters or it's in whatever. It's just they give him so much technical jargon and he loves it. And it sounds good coming out of his mouth. And that's why it's where you get all that wonderful stuff in Ghostbusters, all that nonsense ghost science stuff that sounds good. I love him in this. But John Lithgow specifically, I think it is because, like, I immediately got this strange image in my mind, which was thinking about Back to the Future if John Lithgow played Doc Brown instead of Christopher Lloyd. And now, again, you don't touch perfection. Christopher Lloyd's amazing. But just think about that, to think about how well John Lithgow works in a Zemeckis film in that world. It's easy to picture. Is it hard to picture John Lithgow saying the phrase "Great Scott"? It is not.
No,
in fact, I dare say his entire career has been "I am the guy who says shit like Great Scott." you know, and it's also really interesting because, I mentioned Raising Kane or the Brian De Palma film Raising Kane with John Lithgow for See It, everybody. See It and see Blowout and what other movies? A bunch of ones with John Lithgow, Brian De Palma movies. But what was interesting about this is that in Raising Kane, there's a lot of interesting noirish POV gags that involve John Lithgow acting directly into camera with these big wide lenses. So it's felt strongly evocative of that to me, which is around the same time. It was like a 90s movie. I guess from around there, I should have looked up what sequence these things came in. But yeah, that was just another, it just made me wish, like, man, all the attributes we talk about for a perfect Zemeckis actor, just being able to go to 10, to play it up to fucking 11, all of that is all Lithgow, man. And he is, of course, fan-fucking-tastic. Like, after What's-Her-Head gets killed, and he's like, yes!
Oh, I wrote that down.
That's a meme moment.
I wrote that down. Yes! I love the fist pump.
Richard loves the fist pump. No, man, he is fucking rad. Isabella Rossellini. There's so much powerful magic packed into every component of this.
Well, I found it a little distracting, frankly. Like, this was my least favorite of the three. And I've directed some, like, I did a project where I was doing first person stuff, and it's just fucking hard. Like, and I feel like you can feel it. For me, I felt it not quite working at almost every aspect of it.
I think you should see some POV stuff really not work to kind of sort of a palate cleanser.
I've directed
exactly, but it's like there have been, especially in the last couple of years, some really and it's true, of course, and Richard knows as I'm saying this that I have just finished writing a POV horror movie thing. Mm-hmm. So I was looking at a bunch of that kind of stuff, and to really see POV horror not work, and there I won't name names, but there's some examples, and it's just this episode is so dense with ideas, and that means visual ideas, jokes, characters. Oh, it's Isabella Rossellini. Oh my God, she's dressed as her mom. They're doing lines from Casablanca.
Right.
Here's a joke. We're moving the body. Here's a visual gag in the background. Here she's coming. It's so dense with ideas, and that is such an important thing, especially when you're doing POV, especially when you've created a device to limit yourself cinematically. It means you have to work double time to populate what is on screen with a bunch of fun ideas. And that's what, of course, Zemeckis is great at, is that density. I mean, look at all of the, look at the opening shot of Back to the Future, all of that. You know, it's like he doesn't drop the skateboard and then we pan over to the plutonium. It has to roll along the ground and hit the plutonium and make a sound to get our attention. Just like when she closes the door in all through the house. And then it's not just that you rack focus to the keys. The slamming door, has to be blown shut by wind. Rack focus to the keys that have to be shaken off the table and hit to make it sound so we really fucking look at them. It's like, I've lost my train of thought. Now I'm thinking about that episode. Well, what were we just talking about a second
ago? Talking about when you do a POV something like this, you're limited on the long takes and you have to densely pack the frame with things.
It's not about what the camera's doing. It's all about the camera looks up, it looks down, it looks left, it looks right. The thing you can't do, and this is what you learn to appreciate when you're an editor, and we've certainly been editors for a long time, is just you lose the ability to pull all of that air and space and time out of the sequence you only half conceptualized or whatever it is.
Right.
So you have to, with the same rapidity and the same with the same sort of ingenuity, with the same ingenuity with which you would add a bunch of cuts to a movie, you have to now be adding ideas and events and things on the screen in front, and it's told in that dense of a way. If you walk through just the boardroom scene, and again, your mileage may vary on how much you like seeing all the POV mirror stuff with Humphrey Bogart, or how good you think the impression, the Play It Again Sam impression is of Humphrey Bogart. Regardless, but in every moment he is populating that screen. You know, it's the cigarette, then it's the cool, very loaded presentation, and the girl in the red vest, so it's drawing your eye with it. He's always giving you something, and something that's fun, and something that does reward a little bit closer of an examination. And so in a way, I thought it was done quite well, in the sense that, in addition to, the camera moves around a lot and does some cool gags with seeing shit in mirrors and all sorts of stuff, the camera doohickey is almost secondary to just, it's nice to know that there's a filmmaker who knows that when you can't do as much shit with editing in the camera, you have to put a lot more shit on screen. And it's the same principle that underlies those wonders that he does at the beginning of his films. The same principle that underlies all of Spielberg's wonders. It's just putting the ideas in sequence and knowing intuitively how much time needs to take place cinematically between those ideas, which is, as it turns out, faster than you would think. It needs to be denser and faster than you would think.
Always.
Dialogue needs to be faster than it is in the room, you know?
I think that's part of what probably drew him to this, because the story is completely different than the source comic, but the source comic is all first person stuff, and I think this one probably was sitting on a desk and be like, okay, we're gonna do a POV thing because that's what the source material says, and he was like, well, like, I'll swing at it. and he's talked to, I talked a little bit about it on the Death Becomes Her episode of him trying to make, his goal is always to make the scene work without an edit. And always shooting a safety valve so you can edit the scene if you have to, but to try to get the scene to play in the one shot, which he does throughout, even on the first one, the All Through the House. There's a lot of long wonders in there with a one-shot safety valve, and you can see it in Yellow too. But in this one in particular, there's no safety valve.
It's funny. It's this interesting thing where you think about that basic film grammar that we all take for granted as being quote unquote good, and just to kind of expand on that for a moment, that idea of, oh, it works better if it all plays in one shot, or it doesn't need editing, or whatever, the shot has a beginning, middle, and end, and every, you know, and all of that kind of stuff that we take for granted is good. But it's interesting to look back. I think I ended up getting this cool book on John Ford and was rewatching Peter Bogdanovich's film directed by John Ford. And I was just struck by the fact that, oh, right, back in the day when they were making multiple films a year and it was just a bunch of guys out in the West, mm-hmm. just, you know, having fun, you know, taking like horse carriages on dive bomb runs down hills and riding horses and jumping on horses and all sorts of fun stuff. That idea that they had to hand that film off to an editor, and that the idea that which is in fact better artistically to be able to sort of connect a shot together, this element and the camera moves to here, and then we follow this guy over here, and we go from a close to a wide, and to tell the camera the story in camera, we take for granted as being like this purely aesthetic evolution, like it's the medium becoming more sophisticated. But then the observation was made that well John Ford would shoot these shots and then shoot very little else around them or whatever right. he had. And I began to think about it as it's interesting to think about that aesthetic, and part of it was not wanting to shoot coverage so it wouldn't get screwed up by an editor. So they kind right. of mentioned that idea and realizing that that aesthetic innovation in some sense being driven by almost shooting defensively. Like,
right.
I will put the film together and show you assholes the order I want to see it in so that in a time when they didn't have Final Cut and they weren't in the editing room, you
there
know,
were no
they
options.
Could essentially, yeah, there were no options. It's like, this is the story, you know, it and that's it. And well, it's Scorsese. So funny to think of. Yeah.
Scorsese did that in the famous, what am I, a clown? Do I amuse you? He shot it.
Oh, yeah.
Like, in just those wides, there's no other coverage of that because he was like, I don't want to lose the physical mm-hmm. reaction and the group of guys behind him.
Oh, for sure. Well, so much about what makes that moment work and many things is just populating the frame with multiple faces. Like, that is a scene that would not work, you know, because it's so much of about that scene is about the social pressure and the fact that they're right. being watched and that it is all of that. And the fact is, if they'd played that scene like in Goodfellas in close up and then had to cut away to the reaction faces, you as an audience member would not be able to look at those faces on screen. And as they get nervous and they look and they start to wring their hands and they try and calm the situation down and all of that. So yeah, man, it's just yeah, it's, but it, again, all of those things we take for granted is just they make the frame better, they make the storytelling better. But it's so funny to think about some of these innovations being not derived from where they would be, you know, even 20 years later as like little artist kings, you know, little directors putting together their shots and their final cut and their whatever in the editing room. Instead, a guy who's like, listen, I have another movie to get to, like I'm finishing this movie today, I'm starting another one tomorrow, I need to make sure the editor doesn't fuck this one up like he did the last one. So I'm giving him no fucking options. This whole scene is all in one shot and that's it. Just a fun, anyway, well, film I history, think, kids. It's fun.
I think just thinking back to some of the stuff I've learned about Zemeckis, like his family was not super well off in the Chicago area, suburbs. Like, I don't think quite paycheck to paycheck, but like he spent a lot of time, like, just the television was his world. That was the window into everything mm-hmm. else, and where things were a bit more magical and a bit better. And thinking about his style, and especially some of the scenes with Kirk Douglas and Eric Douglas in Yellow, where you look at his frames and thinking of, we've talked about how he shoots long takes and he shoots wide. There's not a lot of close-ups, and that's kind of a television like proscenium thing. It's kind of how shit was set up when mm-hmm. like in the three camera thing, a lot of things just played in wides, you mm-hmm. know, and all the John Ford stuff plays in wides. And just from a mm-hmm. learning media thing, it seems like the fact that he watched a lot of television, at least, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but that feels like something that has influenced the way he sees.
Yeah, well, there's such a strong sense of fundamentals with Zemeckis, but then there's also that playfulness where mm-hmm. he doesn't use the fundamentals to disappear. He uses them to play jokes on the audience, like the whole chestnuts on the roasting over the open fire gag at the beginning of the thing. Like, he lulls you into a sense of, like, this is what these shots are used for, and then we're going to eventually arrive at someone on the phone, and then she's going to start talking, and then the movie will begin. And so, because it's clearly with this, it's all about tone, it's all about setting, it's all about right. a little bit of exposition. There's a child in the house because we see the note. It's Christmas night because there's milk and cookies out, whatever. And then you realize that whole vibe is to set up a perverse joke about a fire poker going into a guy's head. And then even that even though that is sort of a microcosm of the entire film right there, even that is a setup for a switcheroo gag with a dummy head. And it's, so it's like, it's such a strong sense of those fundamentals, but with this idea, this very playful idea of like, what if we turned it on its head? Or wouldn't it be funny if the end of this long, cool shot of like, if you look at, I don't know, some...
Back to the Future, when he's walks into school late and he has the confrontation with the principal. It's a big, long dolly take, and it ends in like...
With noses touching.
With noses touching. Like, yes, it's big, it's long, like, shots that end on a joke.
It ends with a boop, at the end.
Yeah, and speaking of the fundamentals, one thing I noticed, even just not ending in a gag, I mean, it kind of is a gag because of the line, but in the... And all through the house, when her daughter asks her, what did you ask for Christmas, Mommy? It doesn't cut to her. It does a big camera move that draws weight to her response of her saying, I already got it. But it's done without a cut. And so you get her line is the gag. But even if you remove the gag from that shot, like that, the movement carries weight and draws you into that response.
For
which
sure.
Is so, and that's, wonderful to see. So wonderful
well, that's,
to see.
Which, that line, by the way, is a great example of, you know, that line is a great example of, it's like, what's the point of all this crap? You know, of like your shots that go along and you're setting up all this kind of stuff. The point of all of that, you know, is that, I don't know, in cinema, like, good cinema and good writing have to exist simultaneously. So you need to build all of that character just into those images so that when you ultimately deliver a line like, well, what do you want for Christmas, Mommy? And you pull up and I've already got it. And the idea that this was her Christmas present is loaded with all of this perverse... it's like the idea behind the line is, okay, it's something about Christmas that feels very homey and feels like a wish fulfilled and prayers answered, of course, but the thing is murder. And so it has a deliciously sacrilegious component to it and all of that. And can you achieve that without building all of that subtext in visually? Can you achieve all of that? Yeah, you can communicate that point, but it will, when that line arrives, it will strike you as hollow as compared to when you cultivate all of this cool magic. You are in a position where you are already, you know, you're just cultivating all the cinematic energy. You're already in this cool position where it's like, yeah, it's a kind of wry, funny line in a noir movie, but at the same time, like, it's now loaded with all kinds of meaning that has just been channeled directly into that character about Christmas, about the murder, about all of that kind of stuff. So we know that everything that therefore follows it, when she's dragging the body and the thing that's obscuring the door is slowly closing, or her keys literally are vanishing into the snow and all of that, it has a deliciously spiritual component to it. I say deliciously because it was in that one movie, The Witch. Remember that movie?
Oh, yeah.
Everyone got super big on the word deliciously after that for like 5 minutes. Remember that, Richard?
I do remember it. Yeah, I barely remember.
Same, Richard.
I derailed us back to and all through the house. Is there anything else you wanted to touch on with...
No, I don't even remember how we got onto that, to be honest.
Cinema grammar, I think.
Yeah. Oh, I think it was also just the... Yeah. Just the idea that, you know...
Which we both care deeply about. Deeply about cinema.
Well, it's not an issue. Like, it's not even like the formalism is cool for its own sake, but it's like... And this is what I at least took a long time for me to try and learn, or what I try and communicate when I'm talking to people about writing who are struggling with it a little bit more, is it's just, and again, I am certainly no expert, but what's inspiring about this kind of cinema is seeing how the textual elements and the visual elements, which is to say the sort of material and the spiritual elements, how, like, work and reinforce and strengthen each other. And so it's not an issue of like, we care about it because it's good to do it the old way, because that's how John Ford did it, because that's how Orson Welles did it. It's not that. It's so that when you get to the moment, you don't have to have a 7-minute Netflix television conversation about why the husband and who the husband and when, and but he was a stepdad and all of this. You can keep it very lean and sparse, and all of those emotional associations that you were hoping to conjure with your talky dialogue scenes instead are already conjured by the time you get there. And so you can pack this dense and delightful and scary and really kind of subtextually and thematically rich. I mean, even if you might think it's a little, you know, on the nose or whatever, it's Silent Night, Deadly Night, whatever it is, you know, it's just, it's a different language that increasingly as we pull away from the 90s and we pull away from that period, we were beginning to kind of get some perspective on it, was that you don't see it as much anymore. You see it from a few people, but you don't see it as much anymore.
And I think that that ties into your, just one of the things that you've taught me is just concretizing those ideas into physical objects, which goes back to your point about spirituality and religion and that we talked about earlier. It's like it's imbuing, you're suddenly imbuing these things magically that are holding the thematic weight rather than about it.
Yeah, and if you want to take like, and you don't even have to, of course I use the term like spiritually largely kind of as a metaphor, but it's really just like listening to Nat King Cole, it is a record that is playing in the room, but it immediately puts you, music is the easiest example because it just even bypasses the conceptual faculty. It just evokes a Christmas vibe. And then you're thinking about a well, and then you're thinking about these things. And then you're thinking when you hear chestnuts roasting open in fire, and then you see the fire poker, you're thinking about a world in which the idea of Christmas is kind of being inverted and all this. We keep talking about it over and over again. But it allows you to travel light and strike hard cinematically, if you want to put it in kind of martial arts terms, so that all those ideas already arrive there by the time you say your one line, and they kind of can explode with humor or with ideas or with, you know, scary shit or whatever it is. You know, and versus if you can say, long shots are indulgent, they're just directors wanking off. We could knock that all out with a line of dialogue. And then you say, that line of dialogue doesn't quite do it. Let's add another, and another, and another. And all of a sudden, you're watching that Dark Crystal show where it's like the Dark Crystal if people pull off to the side every 5 minutes to have 9-minute conversations about backstory. I watched the first episode. I haven't watched the rest of the show. It looks rad. That was my big thing. It's like Dark Crystal if people just broke off and talked for 9 minutes between the scenes with it previously we get it. They're evil fantasy space vultures. We know they're bad. You don't have to explain it. And now we're talking about the Dark Crystal. We should talk more about Jim Henson later, which brings us back to the witches. Witches Month, Richard. Yeah, I did it. Yes.
I can't wait to see the new one. Drops tomorrow. I don't know when this episode is going
to
drop.
We're going to do a immediate reaction to the Witches episode, and then I'm going to rewatch the original Witches tonight. Same. with my girlfriend who has never seen it before. She will enjoy it. And then we're going to rewatch we're going to watch the new one when it drops on HBO Max. Yeah, I just said drops. I'm hip.
Yeah.
When it's posted to the internet, Richard, we'll watch it. Is it playing in theaters? Can I go see it in a theater?
I don't think so. I think it's all streaming. I'm reading the book. I'm kind of excited.
Robert Zemeckis, if you're listening to this, we have theaters in Austin. Please.
I feel
in Austin, Texas, it's not happening.
I feel like the book is perfect for him. Reading the book, I feel it's going to be good. I'm excited to watch it. Kyle, any final thoughts on Tales from the Crypt?
Oh man, I feel like there's funny. I kind of watched these very, very quickly, like as you know, immediately before this started.
Well,
I
finished, you were fresh. You came into fresh.
Came in so fresh. I was finishing Yellow like right as I was setting up the computer. So maybe that. Maybe I didn't. Maybe that's my bad. It's interesting. I wish I had given myself a little more time with this for various reasons, just because this I think is a testament to Robert Zemeckis and to just what is present and why you should watch Tales from the Crypt and why people should look at shit from that period instead of just watching Netflix series all the time, is there was so much going on in the history of horror and cinema and ideas and themes and stuff in every one of those three episodes that I realized that instead of like, oh, well, it's three episodes of a horror anthology show, there will be less to talk about in this episode. Instead, there was
almost too much.
just think about that relative to any contemporary sort of horror anthology you might see where it's like, oh,
or really any TV show. Frankly.
Yes. I mean, or it's like but looking even at horror anthologies and things specifically, which became more popular in recent years, there's a lot of stuff going out there where it's just you can do more with horror. You can do a little that it doesn't have to be it's David Cronenberg, but again, you know, you can there's you can load in lots of fun ideas and all sorts of stuff. Anyway, the point being, it was wonderful to see, like, God damn it, there's all this fruit to talk about, you know, in obviously in All Through the House, definitely in You Murderer, which I like the little play, like I Jury, kind of the Mickey Spillane thing.
Yeah,
that's very rad. And then same thing, even with the Two-Fisted Tail that we got to watch today, Yellow, same thing. I don't know. It's just,
There's a lot. It's really, really dense. And I think just in terms of, like, pushing people to watch it, and you're listening to a Zemeckis podcast, like, he was critical into getting the show made. Like, the show got greenlit when he joined Donner and Walter Hill and Joel Silver, fresh off of Roger Rabbit being a big deal. So he's kind of the reason that the show exists. It got greenlit because HBO wanted another director, and Zemeckis was the third guy. So, like, critically important to the show existing. And then you watch these episodes and you see him kind of playing in the smaller space, and it's obviously, like you're saying, it's so wonderful to see stuff this dense and in this short form too. It's I love that Christmas episode. It's like you're saying, it's jam packed of stuff, and never kind of rests. It's all constantly changing and evolving and running to the finish line, which is awesome to see in a television episode that's only like 22 minutes.
So, Richard, quick question: what's some other anthology horror that you have seen or dug? Have you watched any other anthology horror things? Because I'm thinking about, there was Tales from the Dark Side growing up. There was
I just recently watched the original Tales from the Crypt, which is got some interesting stuff in it worth giving a watch. But I didn't grow up with this stuff. I was my parents didn't let me watch it. My dad didn't show it to me when I was younger. So all the stuff that I kind of came to was through you and living with you and Cliff. So, like, I've seen Creepshow, which I enjoyed, and that was not what I thought it was based on the poster. I thought it was going to be this scary. I remember the poster very vividly because it scared me as a child, and it scared me off of the movie, even in my teens. Like, I just had no interest in watching it because I assumed it would scare the bejesus out of me. But no, I didn't watch it until you guys were like, oh, you haven't seen Creepshow? We got to watch Creepshow. Which I only remember the Stephen King, the sad death of Jody Verrill. What's his line about? Oh, it's green stuff. Or
Jody Verrill, you lunkhead. That Verrill luck is always in. You spell that luck B-A-T. Meteor shit.
That's really the only
Creepshow,
one.
Creepshow is the big one. Yeah, that's sort of right out there. Obviously, also an adaptation of Tales from the Crypt. And definitely shout out to our buddy Ryan Spindell, who made a very good horror anthology film now available on Shudder, which I will just chill for right now because he's great. If you want to see a horror anthology with effort put behind it,
every one of those is good. Yes, great, it's very, very good. That was my.
If you want to see all
things.
All that cinema we were talking about. No, we really that is rad. And just Ryan is a great appreciator of horror anthologies as a genre. So,
which is why he made one.
Which is why he made one. That's right. Weirdly, the night that I arrived in LA, we were all supposed to go see the screening of Kwaidan that we couldn't go to, which is another great horror anthology thing several months ago. So maybe we all need to get together at some point, Richard, you and me, and we need to watch Kwaidan, which is another.
Yeah, that
which,
would be great.
That's a cool Japanese horror anthology.
Well,
thing,
I'll be near you. I'll be near you for Christmas. We can do some episodes live and watch some other stuff like Kwaidan.
That's right.
And The Player.
And The Player. Yes, Richard.
And the other stuff we've been mentioning.
You know what you'll love, Richard?
The Player.
You're going to love that.
I probably will love The Player. Yes. I just was turned off by Altman early in college because I didn't like the way he mixed sound.
I think the revulsion to the... I think I can understand why people were turned off by The Player because I feel like every kind of like semi-smarmy grad student film professor we have shows you a clip from The Player to like
the
let you know how much
it.
Hollywood sucks.
Yeah.
Like, and so I was like, yeah, I get it, but I kind of also like movies, and so I associated it with just not my vibe initially, but then I watched it very relatively. I think I ended up seeing it in film school and really dug it, and then revisited it recently, and man, it's good, man.
Yeah, I'm
just sort of doing a whole Altman rewatch and kind of watching through all of his stuff right now. Some of the things I hadn't seen, like I had not seen California Split, which I found out was like the first movie to use lav mics, just so we're apparent, like where that were all wired to separate channels such that he could mix different dialogue together, which is something
sense.
I knew about, which you definitely see him using in a lot of other movies, but I had not seen California Split with Elliot Gould and George Segal. George Segal, I'm also on a huge kick of his. I just watched The Hot Rock with him and Robert Redford the other day, but that's a rad movie too, Richard. And
Altman, going through Altman would be a good exercise for us on a pod.
Yes, that would be rad. Yeah. By the way, weird question. I don't know if this is accurate.
Yeah, ask it.
Maybe this is a factoid we can look up. At the beginning, it almost sounded like it was Bill Paxton on the phone as the guy who she was having the affair with. There was some quality to his voice. Mm. I didn't bother looking it up, but there was just some quality to his voice that was very like, you know, I'm telling you, man, the vet gets him wet, because he was just like, I'm out partying. And I wonder, he was in another Tales from the Crypt episode, a really crazy one about an ice cream man and him eating butter, which you should watch, Richard. And being Texans, we love us some Bill Paxton.
And so, butter.
Sound off in the comments. Should we do a Bill Paxton podcast, everybody? Let us know.
It's not listed. I just looked it up. So that would take some real digging to find out if that was Paxton. But I do love Bill Paxton. You're right.
You gotta love Paxton. Well, I'm glad we just sort of kind of on a lark. We're like, hey, we can put all this spooky shit in October. We should be do it, I guess. And I'm really glad we did, because it has helped watching these Tales from the Crypt episodes, watching Death Becomes Her, talking about them. Now we're going to watch The Witches tonight, watch The Witches, the remake again. This is really putting me in a good vibe. And this is a big, important Zemeckis-y time, Richard. The 26th is coming up in a couple of days. That's in Death Becomes Her, 35th anniversary of October 26, 1985. It's in Back to the Future, Death Becomes Her. It's Cliff's birthday, my brother's birthday, so we'll see what happens there.
Maybe we'll launch an episode on that day.
Yeah.
Could be this one, actually.
We absolutely should. It's the Zemeckis High Holiday, Richard. It's the day in which we can communicate with the dead of the Zemeckis world. So we could perform some magical rituals, take psychedelics, and channel Forrest Gump. We could bring him here. We could party with him.
Sounds
he runs really fast, Richard.
Or just, oh yeah, he does
long.
Run fast.
He does run fast for football. He has both capacities. He's a multidisciplinary athlete, Richard. He cross trains.
Yes. All right. Well, what's the next one? I guess The Witches is next, but that may release earlier than this. But an episode's going to be coming, probably Back to the Future at some point, A Witches at some point. But
yeah, happy Halloween, everybody, and let us know if you've enjoyed
Spooky
Witches
time.
Month.
Spooky time.
Yeah, you guys can reach us on the comments on the Instagram.
Yes.
Just comment on the thing, and I'll respond.
Yes. So look at our forthcoming Witches stuff. And then I guess coming up in November, Richard, we're going to be jumping back in with the remaining Back to the Futures. And
Forrest Gump!
And with Forrest Gump. So that'll be a big Zovember, if you will.
Yes. And there's also Johnny Bago, which we got to figure out how we're going to do that one. But that's a whole other thing, which is right around the same time.
That's
but yes,
obviously.
Kyle, I got to tell you, I am really excited to watch Forrest Gump again. Like, I feel like all this has been leading to that moment.
I feel in a weird way, you're right, because a lot of it began with conversations about Forrest Gump and the strange place it has in a conversation about 90s movies. And then we made that, obviously, the art for the show, and we play that Brian, who we had on for an episode, composed a Forrest Gump theme. So we've all kind of been building up towards this idea of, if you watched The Hypothesis, if you watched all of Robert Zemeckis' filmography prior to Forrest Gump, would it alter your view of that film? Would it inform that differently? And I could say, we have conjured a lot of powerful magic around Robert Zemeckis, Richard. It's going to be a different viewing experience, no doubt.
Very, very different. And
Richard, should we watch that on October 26th? On the 35th anniversary of the day Marty went back in time?
I mean,
35th anniversary of the day that Hell drank the magical potion from Isabella Rossellini, who is also in this episode of Tales from the Crypt?
Yeah, let's watch it, because I think that one is going to take us we're going to have to engage with it for a while to do the show properly.
Should we drink ergot, though, before we watch? Not only poisonous ergot, but an ergot-derived psychedelic substance in wine, and perhaps evoke some powerful angel magic around
it. I'm going to leave the angel magic up to you. You tell me
what
to do.
We're going to figure it out,
man. Yeah. It's all a process. Wonderful journey. All right, well, the next one's going to be the next one, whatever it is. Later, buttheads.
Later, buttheads.
Bye.